Good morning, and it's time for conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon, and a cold WIP day it's going to be, but no matter where you go, hot conversation here on 94 WIP. And when we come back in just a bit, Tuesday's election day. Remember, it's important that you vote. I can't say it enough. Vote, vote, vote. The future of our country, the future of our democracy, depends on your involvement. And to sort of wind up, the look we've been having for the past several months on the election, when we come back in just a bit, Bob Newman, our spin doctor on all things political, and we're going to take a look in these final moments of the election of 2018. All this and more when we come back here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. And we're back. It's Conversation. My name's Peter Solomon. It's 94 WIP. And it's the Sunday before Election Day, Tuesday Election Day. Do you know where your polling place is? Have you selected your candidates yet, or do you wait till you go into the booth? No matter what you do, remember to go do it. Voting is critical to our democracy. Voting is critical to our future. And I'm pleased now to welcome, for maybe one final time pre-election, Bob Newman, Newman Communications. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Peter.
Are you going to breathe a sigh of relief that it's over on Tuesday?
Come again, say again?
Are you going to breathe a sigh of relief that it's all over on Tuesday?
I think I am. I think what I'm probably worried about is afterwards there'll be far more angst and far more conflict based on what the results probably will be.
Okay. Well, we're going to try and pick apart some of that fear of angst and conflict in just a bit. But until then, the thing that's on my mind and on a lot of people's mind was the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. You think that's going to help or hurt the Democrats and the Republicans?
I think it will definitely help the Democrats. I think over the past week or so, the three events that occurred, the two murders that were in Kentucky, the bomber, sending these bombs to many Democratic operatives, especially the ones that President Trump had targeted in his speech, not only individuals, but organizations, CNN being one of them, as we recall. And then lastly, just the most horrific act that we have seen of recent in American history, the killing of 11 innocents walking in, the individual walking in to their shul, to their synagogue, and destroying that one sacred piece that they have to weekly go worship. And it was done in front of a baby naming ceremony. This really set a new low for what our culture is. And I do believe that there are many Americans out there that believe that the speech, that the jabs, that the bullying that comes out of Donald Trump on a given day at the rallies in which he has what was the trigger? What was the cause here? On the one hand, he will argue back to you that that individual was not necessarily a supporter, had been, in conflict with him. Well, the individual who committed this act, and the best thing that we can do is follow the good line of CNN, which is not even to mention the individual's name. That individual didn't think that Trump went far enough, and that's really a low that they so questioned the synagogue for the week before supporting an immigration organization, an organization who for years has helped, a Jewish organization who has helped immigrants settle within the area, had an event. That individual who committed the act saw that and decided to do what he had done and destroyed not only the peace in a community, but destroyed many lives themselves. And I do think it is tied back to the White House, and that if there are individuals who were on the fence at that point, looking and saying, hey, you know what, the economy's been good, and I got a little bit of a tax cut out of that, and, you know, out of this administration, and saw some positives outside, you know, this bellicose behavior out of the executive, I think they, you know, at that point said, I can't take it anymore. They have heard about the lives that were shattered from a 97-year-old, you know, to two brothers who were mentally challenged, but really the pillars of that community. And I think it definitely will. And I don't think it definitely will just in Pennsylvania, Peter, at all. I think, you know, you go throughout the country and people have heard this. This was really on display this past Friday night, where Jewish synagogues throughout the country had these Sabbath services that were in memory, that were in honor, and that of what happened at the Tree of Life Synagogue. So if a chill didn't go up your spine this past week, which I know it did, then, you know, I have to question the individual out there. And will that trigger them when they go to the polls? Sure it will there. But it will within a whole group of incidents that are going on. Peter, I do think that that there's an unraveling going on in our country, a much larger one. I think Tree of Life was one part of it. I think those in the GOP think there's an unraveling in immigration. I think those think that there is an unraveling in the media. And in the GOP, they think there's an unraveling between what the gender roles are of men and women. And I think the Democrats also see an unraveling, that the sense of unity and tolerance in our country has come apart. I think this election is going to be about an existential, you know, angst that people feel. I think people fear that something is really happening in this country, that while healthcare and immigration should be the issues that we're talking about, there's more of a, as I said, a deep sense of something wrong, of unraveling, that, you know, civility has been destroyed, and that, you know, the Democrats especially have looked at what comes out of the White House these past 2 years and have said, this is really not the direction our country has gone to. And I have, you know, many facts to go over with your audience that will talk in terms of what women will do and what young people will do in this election.
Okay, but before we get to those, I want to flip the rhetoric question around a little bit and talk about a recent sitcom I watched that referred to the president as the devil's sidekick. Is that any more or less helpful?
That he's the devil's sidekick?
Yes.
I think undoubtedly he is. And I think many came into this administration believing, Peter, that this individual, the president, was a buffoon, you know, was a circus act, was a clown there. And I think many now look at it and say that on a given day, you know, this rhetoric that comes out of him, rhetoric that is often racist, rhetoric that is often against women, rhetoric that is against, you know, different nations, this attitude that he has, that he has to incessantly bully, he will be on tonight. HBO's new show that Axios, the new service, is putting out. And he will say in that interview, when they question his behavior, when they question his character, he will say, this is the way I always have been. okay? And so I think, again, America looked and they thought with Donald Trump, they were getting somebody who was going to be, you know, kind of a fool out there. And instead, they really do have in Donald Trump, you know, somebody who on a day-to-day basis looks at how he can, you know, gin up the anger, gin up the angst. And most importantly, Donald Trump will acknowledge in interviews, as he has this week, as he will in the Axios interview, that he looks to breed fear on a given day. That's where he thinks that others can come back to him and look and say, you know, this is somebody who is going to protect me. And this is why he, for the past 2 to 3 weeks, more so than he has done before, okay, he has always wanted to light a match on the gas that is immigration. But what he has done in the past week to 2 to 3 with the caravans, which we're talking about the invaders, talking about the mobs, really, you know, does connect and show that he really is the devil's partner here.
But name-calling is name-calling, no matter who does it, whether you talk about Republicans calling Democrats or Democrats calling Republicans, isn't it? And not helpful.
There always has been in American history this type of name-calling in political campaigns. I mean, no doubt. Name calling, you know, has been, you know, to some degree, you know, people look away and say, you know, that's just politics. I on the show for years have said politics is like upgraded professional wrestling. But Trump has taken name calling to a new degree here. And what Americans really worry about is that the name calling itself is often tied to race. It's often tied to individuals in race. It's often tied to intelligence in race. Historically, we have seen that. And if you take an example like him, you know, him calling Maxine Waters low IQ Maxine. I'm not a huge fan of Maxine Waters by any means, but he always uses those terms that for many years have been tied to racial stereotypes. So you can have name calling, you know, you can call even like as he did with Chuck Todd at NBC called Sleepy Eyes, or even when he called Chuck Schumer, you know, crying Chuck, you know, at that point, making fun of when he was emotional. But really now we've taken this to a much higher degree in terms of these, you know, racial epithets, these racial threats. He won't say the words directly, okay? Even, okay, Michael Cohen this past week coming out through Vanity Fair, whether you believe it or not, you know, talking once again about, you know, the president's direct comments driving through areas where people of color live. That's just not calling names. That's taking this to a new low here. And I do believe that's the unraveling that I talked about that Americans no longer want. And when I say Americans, I'm referring to young Americans who are going to the polls. I'm referring to women and especially college-educated women who are going to the polls. And I am referring to many in the Republican Party who believe at this point that a message does need to be sent to the White House about, you know, the behavior that the president has displayed, that it is not within the character of that office, Peter, or within the character of who should be a leader. And that it doesn't, you know, display really a good example for our next generation here. And that's why you see people not wanting to go to the White House, sports teams not wanting to, you know, go and do their, your congratulations of a Super Bowl, of a World Series, of a basketball or hockey championship. And many Americans have tried to put out a message here to the White House that this isn't working. I think this voting, as you said in the introduction, may be the most definitive message that can be given. Will he listen? No, he'll come up with another excuse on why that necessarily happened. But what I can tell you is that he will then have a lot of whispers in his ear about what will happen in 2020 if, as I will predict, you know, as we go through more of the election-oriented pieces here, the Republicans may keep the Senate, but I do believe in the end, and I'm getting to the conclusion of what we'll talk about, that in the House, the Democrats will take 32 to 35 seats, which will give them a 12-seat gain in control of the House. And at that point, our next 2 years are going to be filled with far different than, which again, may be very negative, but far different of what we've had when the Republicans have controlled all three areas of the government.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. We're sort of having our election campaign wrap-up with Bob Newman, Newman Communications, our expert on all things political. My name's Peter Solomon. Bob, what about the caravans? He's predicting that he may send up to 15,000 troops to the border. What do you think about that?
Yeah, the caravan clearly is no different than Trump saying 2 weeks ago he was going to put in a tax cut in the next 2 weeks for Republicans. Okay, there's a couple things with the caravan. Americans do not believe him because he already pulled back on it. He already has had to correct himself. He corrected himself, Peter, on the tax cut, and now he's corrected himself on the if they throw rocks, we will shoot back. Okay, and you know, it's interesting. We heard from Nigeria, I think it was Nigeria yesterday, who said, "Oh, if Trump can say that, we can do that here too." You know, which is shoot back, and Trump has now pulled back on that with the caravan. Is he going to send 15,000 troops? I don't believe he is. Is he going to send 5,000 troops? He may. This group has so dwindled down to 4,000 beings at this point. So, you know, we talk about ratios of, you know, teacher to student. There's going to be ratio of serviceman to person in the caravan. That's going to be over one, you know, one for each individual in the caravan. I don't believe Secretary Mattis will necessarily allow this. Now, let's put that into context. Is Secretary Mattis, Jim Mattis, going to resign, you know, come the beginning of the second half of the first term of the administration? Yeah, I think he is. But in large part, I believe that the troops who are going down there are not going to be at that 15,000 level. I believe the troops who are going down there are know what their rules of engagement are, Peter, and they know, as they have been quoted, that you do not shoot, you do not fire on civilians. So this, again, let's go back to what it is. I'm telling you what's going to happen, but this, again, is an election ploy. He is just trying to gin up the electorate to be worried, to be scared of these terrible mobs. I already told you twice where Donald Trump has pulled back. Let's talk about the third time when it comes to the mobs and the caravans, about who's in it. Donald Trump wanted to tell us in those caravans that there were Middle Easterners in there. Okay? He was trying to threaten that amidst there, those from Syria, those from ISIS, from Al-Qaeda, from Hezbollah had slipped in there. Donald Trump admitted this past week he has no idea who is in the caravan. So he throws out this red meat to his people. He gets them all worked up. You know, and I think what Donald Trump realized when he pulled back on this last one about Middle Easterners and such, I think he realized that he had thrown so much red meat out that there was potentially blood on his hands for the massacre that occurred in Pittsburgh. Donald Trump does that. He throws this all out, not knowing, as we all have said in our culture, that words matter, okay? And you have people like Paul Ryan and others who say, you know, what Donald Trump is saying can't be true. Let's throw the next one in tied to Paul Ryan, Peter. Let's throw in the 14th Amendment. Donald Trump saying that he was going by executive order because he had talked to, as he always says, very smart attorneys, people who know the law well. By the way, I thought that Mr. Trump had told us in the past that he knew better than people. He did that last week about science because he had an uncle who was a professor at MIT. But Trump often says he knows more than the generals. He knows more than the lawyers. Well, he talked to a bunch of lawyers who told him he can put in an executive order that will get rid of the 14th Amendment, okay? He's throwing red meat out to his people. I think what America isn't used to, Peter, is, and they're starting to see through that tax cut, through the 14th Amendment, through the rocks, through all of it, is that they're dealing with somebody, A, who lies constantly, who is ignorant constantly, who makes things up, and who is just trying to move towards the base. And that's one of the things about the election, is that both parties are saying to themselves, we don't really want to win over the other side. What we're really looking to do is just get our base out there. And that's what he is really trying to do. He believes he won in 2016 with certain numbers. He believes he can in the states. He may be right when it comes to the Senate. He is not right when it comes to those House districts that are in question here.
Mm. All right. The Georgia governor's race, if you have a thought, in terms of the Republican candidate, also in charge of elections for the state of Georgia, it's like the fox supervising the hen house.
Yeah, and he is still going to court, still trying to trigger this. This, for your audience, is where Stacey Abrams is going to try and become the first black female governor within our country. This has attracted celebrities, Oprah Winfrey. It has attracted President Obama to be there for her. I think that, again, he has been extremely transparent. You know, that one is a toss-up at this point. And I don't mean to say there are constantly toss-ups, because if you go through the Senate races, I'll tell you exactly who I think will win each, and I'll even, you know, commit to my numbers in the House. But clearly Georgia, where I believe that they often try to suppress voter turnout, and I think this is historical. This former Secretary of State is pushing the pencil way too far, because clearly, like Trump, very similar to Trump, he's scared. I mean, Trump is doing everything he's doing in Washington because at this point he's terribly worried about what the outcome will be and then what the next 2 years will be. I think the Secretary of State looked clearly at the polls in Georgia and realized, I may not win if I don't take, you know, some of these actions. Unfortunately, again, they're setting our country back years and years in terms of our race relations. And, you know, we originally saw that with Trump when it came to Mexicans. We saw it when it came to Trump when it came to Middle Easterners. And I think he has given license not only to other nations, like I talked about with Nigeria, but he's giving license to local candidates to behave in the way that they do and to try to use the law for perverted purposes and for self-centered purposes to stop certain classes of people. So, I mean, in the end, I wish I could predict that race. I'm leaning towards that Stacey Abrams wins, that there is such great turnout in the black community as well as with women that she takes that governorship, and that history in that one election is definitely made. But Peter, there is history that potentially could be made in multiple other elections too. You realize in addition to Georgia, we may have the youngest Congresswoman, Ms. Cortez, in New York named. We may have the first Palestinian American who's elected to Congress. We may have the first Native American who's elected to Congress. And in Pennsylvania, you actually may have a woman congresswoman, Madeline Dean, who was elected, the first one since 2004. So on top of Stacey Abrams, this is an election that will breed many firsts, and they're going to be so diametrically opposed to the type of rhetoric that Donald Trump puts out there in terms of the races, the religions, and such of the people who are running, and especially as I can recite soon, the genders that people are running on, which are just on the Democratic Party, you have so many more nominated who are female than men.
Well, moving along. Celebrities, do they help or hurt when they get involved in a campaign? You mentioned Oprah coming out for Stacey.
I think they do nothing, and I've thought about this. I really do. I think it's a basic zero for it, Peter. They don't help. They don't hurt. I think that they're a positive. They're a negative. And, you have seen this with music stars. You have seen this with the Oprahs of the world. I think that they're a net zero gain here. I think we saw that in the presidential election in Ohio with LeBron James and with others. I wouldn't give a lot of credence to it. It might get some people out to vote on one side. I do think every time you get people out to vote on the left and you excite them, I think the base of the right is probably fortified to move out there. Net gain a tiny bit. And listen, in some of these House races, this may help. But really, I don't think it's significant at all. I think they should go back and do what they do. If they want to talk about it in general, I want to raise the example for the former governor of Tennessee after Taylor Swift came out. Within the next week or so, the polls had gone dramatically towards the Republicans. And so explain that one. She came out for the Democrat. It then went dramatically to the Republicans. And I think the Republicans will maintain that seat despite a Democrat being a former very popular governor. So net zero, if not, it gains it a little, or sometimes it fires up the base as it did in Tennessee, and it hurts.
All right. Something astounded me. I saw a commercial where Mitch McConnell was shown on tape talking about cuts to Social Security, cuts to Medicare, cuts to Medicaid. A dangerous thing to be talking about before an election, isn't it?
Again, they think that they're hitting to the base, okay? I mean, I'm going to kind of twist this a little and say, Trump talks about the caravans. He talks about Iran this week. He's talking about the new three access of Venezuela, of Honduras. McConnell is talking about what you're mentioning. I think they're worried. I think they think that they have been losing momentum, and they're trying to go back to that base. They talk about cuts. The cuts there are going to be people. It's very transparent that those cuts are needed because of the massive tax cuts that have occurred. But they see what's happening in some of these races, and I think it worries them. And it's very base-oriented. 92% of Democrats disapprove of Trump. 87% of the GOP approve of him. I mean, basically, that's where we're at. There isn't that crossover there. So Trump puts out that disgusting ad. Mitch McConnell says, you know, what he does. Trump gets out of the stump and calls, you know, Andrew Gillum, you know, a thief. You know, and again, I can only explain it as you know, for the following, okay? Peter, some background here. Hillary got 66 million votes. Trump got 63 million votes. There are 100 million voters who don't vote. You started off this by saying, and maybe 120 million in the midterms, okay? But this is the largest party, the largest force is those who don't vote, okay? And, you know, and it's very sad. If you read New York Magazine this week, you hear the story of a young man in Georgia who supported Bernie Sanders, who then saw Hillary jump for Sanders, saw what the party they did, you know, did to Sanders, and said, I'm just not interested. The system is corrupt. It's looked like old political hacks. You know, the system is lawless at times. These old men and old women have power. They're not doing anything for me. I think, you know, that's what many young people are doing. So both the Republicans and the Democrats are generally saying, you know, issues don't count and we're really just going to throw red meat out there. You know, the GOP throws out threats and the Democrats come back just as bad and they don't talk about health care. They don't talk about infrastructure. They don't talk about education. They just talk about how bad Donald Trump is. But, you know, something's changing, Peter. 37 million, it went up yesterday from 29 million, have already voted. You know that? That out of, you know, those 100, I mean, out of those, that electorate, 37 million have already voted, a historical high in voting in advance. 27 states have already surpassed early vote tallies from 2014. We're seeing that in Tennessee. We're seeing that in Texas, okay? Potentially, at this point, 30 million ballots have been cast. Last time at this time, 17 million had been passed. Those Democrats are trying to get those 23 seats in the House. They're trying to change the landscape. They're trying to change what the bills are going to be, what the investigations are going to be, and they're trying to turn this. And you even see Paul Ryan. You talked about Mitch McConnell in this question. Paul Ryan has been in 50 cities in 12 states in the last couple of weeks. He's talking about the economy booming 250,000 jobs last month and deregulation and unemployment and the GDP. Trump, on the other hand, he's going back like McConnell and threatening. You know, McConnell's threatening domestically. Trump's threatening the 14th Amendment, the ROCs, and the asylum claimers that he's going to send them back. So, you know, this election also, Peter, has been crazy in terms of money. $5.2 billion has been spent already on this election. $4.2 billion was what was spent in 2012. Do you know in the last week, $79.3 million has been spent by the Democrats in ads? Michael Bloomberg in New York has put in $22.7 million through his PAC. You know, on the other side, the GOP has put in $51.7 million in the last couple weeks in Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and other areas. So I bring up all these facts because everybody is running scared. You know, guys like Sheldon Adelson in the last week, the Republicans are dumping in money, just like Bloomberg is on the other side. They see these races, you know, like, you know, California 21, or they see, you know, races in other states that should have been for the Republicans. But it's really telling about, you were talking about the celebs, where do the candidates, Peter, actually, you know, or the parties actually go? Trump is only playing to his base. You talked about Mitch McConnell. Trump's been in Elko, Nevada. okay? Muskegee, Wisconsin, Belgrade, Montana. I don't mean with my you know, dialect to be questioning it, but he's only been in 9 states: Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Florida, Missouri, Montana, Indiana, West Virginia, Nevada. He's trying to keep the Senate. Let's talk about that, Peter. Why is he trying to keep the Senate? Okay, the House can impeach him, the Senate can remove him. Period. The end. Trump is a self-centered being. Okay, he thinks he's protecting his hide, that there will not be a trial in the Senate after impeachment that will throw him out. Do I think with a 12-vote gain in the 35 seats, but a 12-vote gain that the Democrats under Nancy Pelosi or someone will actually impeach him? I don't know. I kind of tend to doubt it, but if they do, he's protecting his hide in the end. You know, but this election, Peter, just a couple more facts. You can have more women have been running than ever. More Muslim Americans have run. More teachers. More people. I got to tell you two other crazy facts here, Peter. Do you know that Wall Street has given far more money in this election to the Democrats and corporate America has given to the Democrats? America is saying, from young people to women to Wall Street to corporate America, we're kind of tired of this guy. There are more LGBTQ running. There are more young people who are voting. Okay, millennials don't vote. Okay, but some believe that out of all the millennials in the country, only 20% have voted. Some believe the statistics in this election will be that 40% will vote. You got to look on election night what white women, college with degrees, you know, do. But this country is being ripped apart. It's white women with college degrees versus white men without college degrees. You got to look on Tuesday night, your listeners, are the polls still wrong? They were wrong in 2016. Will they be wrong again? Again, will young people be touched by what happened throughout the country? Parkland people and survivors tried to get us to do that, okay? You know, you're going to have to check to see, is there really a blue wave here? I see that the GOP may pick up a seat in western Pennsylvania, but I'll tell you what's really, really telling, Peter. You know that it's easily predictable that no seat out there that's currently held by a Democrat and the Democrats running is going to turn over. There is not one Democratic seat out there. What does that say to you? You know, after the election, there's going to be the Pelosi question. Is she going to be tough enough to deal with Trump? So we really have to figure out, will Trump will he triumph here? Or will he be cornered? Okay, will the Dems in this election be ascendant, or will they be humiliated? I can tell you this: the 2020 elections, as we talk, will be the least civil elections in American history, and that's not a hard one to predict. Okay, I'll segue here and throw it back to you. The hardest one to predict, I think, is down in Texas at this point. I think that Senate race is the one that everybody should look at. If you ask me about North Dakota and Missouri and Tennessee and Nevada, what's going to happen in those Senate races, I can tell you. But could the outlier be the Ted Cruz, Beto O'Rourke race? Yeah, that's the one, if you want to have some fun on election night watching, that's the one to watch.
And you're listening to 94WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Bob Newman, our commentator on all things political. And we're talking about the election of 2018. And as you think about the election of 2018, remember to vote, vote, vote. It's critical. Your vote counts. Bob?
You know, the vote should count because you don't want money just to count. The Texas Senate elections, Peter, they spent $94 million. The Florida Senate elections, the governor against Bill Nelson, $91 million. Okay? There's a Georgia House race that has spent $46 million. There's the Missouri Senate race, Claire McCaskill trying to hold on, which I don't think that she will, $42 million. And, don't count it out. The people in New Jersey still have to make a decision on Bob Menendez. They still have to decide there. I think he'll hold on to it, but I think a message will be sent that corruption is being questioned there. But yeah, vote. Don't let just the big money be what controls this country, okay? But as I said to you, it is pretty surprising. The money from Wall Street and the money from corporate America has gone to Democrats this time. That is both of those groups making a statement on what they think is coming from the White House.
All right.
Despite the fact that, again, he'll tell you how great the economy is. He'll tell you, and it is. You know, the jobs numbers are significant. The GDP is wonderful. I mean, all of this is going well. What does that say, going back to the beginning of the conversation about the devil you talked about? What does that say about the hate speech? What does that say Americans are thinking when they tune in on Saturday morning and they see that a Shabbat service has been destroyed and that 11 innocent lives are taken? It says a lot there. And your president of the United States, my president of the United States, says, we had a great momentum going, but then two people wrecked it. That was what he said. I mean, it was just shocking that within that sentence, he did not, number one, say that I don't believe it's worth, it was appropriate for these bombs to be sent, okay, whether they were good or bad bombs, and those threats to be made. By that crazy individual, and I especially am sickened by what happened in Pittsburgh there, okay? He did not say that. He said back to Americans that he had a momentum and it was crushed by these two individuals. And that's why they now have pivoted with the McConnell, domestic threats as well as the Trump international threats. They believe fear will bring out the base. And as I said to you earlier, they're not interested in new voters. They're just interested in the base.
Some people would suggest that Donald Trump wants to move himself into the White House on a long-term, semi-permanent, if not permanent, basis. What would you say to that?
Is Donald Trump going to do what Michael Bloomberg tried to do in New York? I mean, did in New York, I'm going to take a third term. I'm going to create a crisis here. I think as an individual, he may want to do that on the one hand. Number two, he may be burnt out from it. Number three, that constant investigations that will occur under a Democratic Congress over the next couple of years and potential even articles of impeachment, I think he will want to get out of D.C. pretty darn quickly. I think right now something happened the first year of his administration. He was not comfortable being president. He then became very comfortable being president. He saw his wins there, whether they be Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and such. And so he may have the ideas that you're talking about, but he well has to understand he won't have the Republican Party with him at all, because while he may want to assent to that, royal rule that you're talking about, Peter, there's no way that the Republican Party will allow themselves to be destroyed. And if they lose the House, this will be the first message. You will hear them say this always happens in midterm elections, that you will hear that word razor thin constantly. Well, we only had a razor thin lead in the House here or so. But, there are races throughout the country where there are non-Donald Trumps, running. In Ohio, where congressmen have made racist comments, if they're handed their pass out of Washington, that too will be a message to Trump. I mean, what we're going to have is a continuing of, and you saw this in Bob Woodward's Fear book, You saw it a little bit in the Michael Wolff book. You're really going to have two executive branches going on. You're going to have Donald Trump on a given day who now is, you know, they calculate he does, you know, six, seven hours of executive time, which basically means tweeting, talking to his friends on the phone. And then you have people in the government who are actually trying to do things. You know, the Mike Pompeos and the Jim Mattises warning Saudi Arabia that that they cannot continue this Iranian war in Yemen, and the potential that 30 days from now, as they said this week, we have to get out of that war. I think you're going to have a lot of not only divided government, but you're going to have divided executive branch, because no one's going to want to get to that point. You already saw this, Peter, with the op-ed to the anonymous op-ed to the New York Times, and you saw it with the amount of people who talked to Woodward. It would be a pipe dream for Donald Trump to feel this way. He has to get through 2020, and I think there potentially will be Republican challengers for him in a primary election, and that will be sobering for him also.
Okay. We have a caller this morning here on 94 WIP who wants to talk to Bob Newman. Let's say good morning to Ronnie from Ardmore. Good morning, Ronnie. Okay, Ronnie, your comment or question. Here we go.
There we go. Good morning, Peter, Bob, Ronnie here in Ardmore. To give a little bit different point of view, I follow what's going on, and I'm basically going to focus on Trump. The House is going to be interesting. The House to me, it could go either way. 23-seat margin is not that big of a deal. And like you just got done saying, Bob, yes, the tide usually goes against, going back to Clinton that I can recall, the House gains seats or even overcomes from the opposite party of who's ever holding the executive office. So that's normal. That's just, you know, I think, like I say, going back to Clinton, I don't recall a time when the person in office held the same amount of seats or gained seats. And I guess that's just the way the American people vote. I'm going to go focus again on Trump. And you said earlier, and I wonder how Trump was responsible for the shooting in Pittsburgh, the bombs, Parkland. I don't know how he gets tied to this. Any tragedy that happens like that, the guy from Pittsburgh was vehemently anti-Trump. But yet it's Trump's fault that this guy's shooting a gun off. And it's just wrong. That's where Trump is able to say fake news. I don't like fake news. I say disingenuous news, but that's too many syllables. Fake is, you know, real easy to roll off the tongue. But it's very disingenuous to put that on Trump. Even that bomber, that guy living in a car, right? All of a sudden, this is Trump's fault. I do not get that. But then go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so let's take this slowly for a second. I understand what you're saying as the individual, and politically I too, caller, can sit back and say, come on, if you tie him to this too closely, if you do, it's all going to backfire and he's going to be able to use it against you, okay? So individually, If we're just talking one-on-one, you're right, Donald Trump is not responsible because the human being decided to do it, okay? The first person, okay, you know, he is probably a crazy person, a mentally challenged person. He's probably a person with serious mental illness, okay?
Are you talking Parkland? Because you also mentioned Parkland.
No.
Okay.
No, the only time I talked Parkland is I said, will the young people of Parkland actually be successful in getting out voters? No, I don't think that the Parkland thing had nothing to do with Donald Trump at all.
Okay.
No, the only thing you could say the Parkland thing had to do with is that that there are those in this country who will say gun laws should be a lot stronger, and therefore to be able to walk into Parkland and do what he did and to be able to, but listen, Parkland, I blame that partially on the FBI. Can I be honest with you? They got called.
I do too, yeah.
The FBI
That's where the problem was.
Consistently made mistakes. You want me to go off in the FBI? They got calls about Larry Nassar abusing gymnasts. Okay, it has been for years at the FBI, but let's not go in that direction. Let's talk about these other two. I agree he's not pushing the buttons, but both of them were tied to websites, to social media and such that in large part, caller, are heavily supported by white nationalists who also do support Donald Trump. And there are those who will say if he brought down the rhetoric, especially with the synagogue, brought down the rhetoric in terms of immigration. This was a man who noticed if Trump talks immigration, Trump talks the border, Trump talks the 14th Amendment, Trump talks, you know, rapists from Mexico, Trump talks all of these areas, and this is an individual who noticed that in his community, a Jewish organization had hosted an event the previous Friday night for an organization who helps resettle immigrants. They've been doing it for years, and he specifically targeted that. So where we're going here is Donald Trump has used immigration as the gasoline, as the firebomb over the last, you know, couple of weeks, rather than the economy, his great economy, or other great achievements that he has had, which I would agree he has had, okay? Used immigration. This guy triggered this based on immigration in this organization.
Well, that's good, because that's the other topic.
And he also
he
also is saying, caller, Trump hasn't gone far enough. He's saying, you know, I'm in the group with all the Trumpers, but I think you're all wimping out because Trump is talking out of two sides of his mouth. He hasn't gone to the degree of bringing this country back to a white nationalist nation
I didn't see anything. He did not like Trump. He hated Trump. He said Trump was a puppet of the Jewish people. That's okay. That you went a little too far there. But let's get back on that 14th Amendment. No way. Here we're being very loosey-goosey. He's not repealing or anything with the 14th Amendment. He is questioning and pushing the boundaries. And there are legal scholars saying it doesn't give birthright citizenship. It's something that came in the 60s. It's something that's not enforcing. I think it's good. Let's get it clarified. Let's get it straightened out.
Oh, Carl, I agree with you. The debate is wonderful.
And that's all he's doing. And he throws the red meat out there, I guess.
He said I could do an executive order to end it. Okay? This is a man who complained time and time again that Obama had used executive orders,
correct,
especially with DACA, to run his administration.
I'm not sure, Peter, if you had her on, but there's a fabulous writer that follows Trump, and that's Selena Zito.
No, I haven't.
You have?
No.
I think so. Yeah. She has a marvelous quote where certain people take Trump literally and some people take him seriously. Now, and there's a lot to that, because I get what Trump's saying in the executive order, and he says that, and he shoots his mouth off, but now he has the conversation started. And I'm going to go to a poll that was on C-SPAN Washington Journal, which is on in a couple of minutes, which I watch. They had a poll about birthright citizenship, and 78 or 79% of American citizens are for ending it. That's a remark. Usually you get a poll, it's 54-46, you know, 52-48. That is, and for C-SPAN, C-SPAN's not a right-wing organization. It's right down the middle usually with their polls. There's a poll I trust.
Before Peter has to wrap here, I would ask you quickly this question, okay? Does, in terms of Trump, okay, as the leader, as the executive, as the example here, not as a commentator, I mean, Sharon and him may have been starting a conservative TV station thinking they were going to lose, but they didn't lose. But now as the president, should he find a different manner to introduce these types of debates rather than fear and threat? Okay.
I
think, go on.
Trump went to University of Penn, and his major was marketing. He knows how to get the conversation started. He obviously knows business, but his major was marketing. So, and that's pretty much how he ran his whole life, is put a Trump name on something and you run with it. He puts the conversation out there in a blunt, maybe ugly way, but the conversation is now being had, being debated. People are going back and forth. I have friends at work that are first-generation immigrants, and there was a heated argument just this past week over somebody who was saying, oh, Trump can't do this to the 13th, or they can't just come in here. My friends were the first generation. It almost got to a fist fight where a guy was from Dominican Republic, one guy was from China, and one guy's from India. And the first generations were very upset that these people are walking across the border.
Peter, I know you got to go, but I would rather see that debate on health care, on taxes, on infrastructure, on corporate finance and elections. I'd love to see it on these issues rather than always going to the downside, always going to the fear, always going to the mobs,
I'll see them all, too, but this is also something that's on the top of the list here. So anyway, since you got to wrap up, I'll take the hint. Well, maybe I'll call next week and we'll see what happens. But I think the Republicans may keep a one or two seat edge. It's going to be that tight, but that might be wishful thinking, too.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank
guys,
you.
Have a good weekend. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Bob Newman. It's always instructive. Lord knows what's going to happen Tuesday, because I sure don't. Thank you, Bob.
We'll see you on the other side.
Bye. And let me remind folks, vote, vote, vote. And starting debates by fear, with something when we look back in history, people like Dr. Joseph Goebbels, henchman to Adolf Hitler, used that very same tactic to start a debate in Nazi Germany. My personal opinion. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. If you can't, nothing left to say, but see you soon. Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIP as we ease on into a chilly WIP Sunday. Chilly outside, hot conversation inside. Here at 94 WIP. Election Day is Tuesday, and many issues are going to be decided, at least by your vote, if not directly, indirectly. And one of the issues I think that we might want to think about is historic preservation. The federal government puts a lot of money into historic preservation, whether it's national parks, national monuments, national museums. And what's going to happen to that in the proposed Trump budget? People say nothing good. And that's one of the questions we're going to ask my next guest, Monica Rhodes. Monica comes to us from the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Good morning, Monica Rhodes.
Hey, good morning, Peter. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. First of all, what is the National Trust?
The National Trust for Historic Preservation is a private nonprofit based in Washington, D.C., and we preserve and protect historic resources all around the country, and we've been doing so since 1949.
And some of the properties you own directly, and some of them you just give money to, correct?
So we own 28 historic sites around the country, and that Clifton, located in Germantown in Philadelphia, we have a partnership with them as well, a co-stewardship agreement, rather. And then for the other sites, we bring our resources, either our preservation, marketing, and other services to these structures and historic places that matter to help preserve them. And we do that through the National Treasures Campaign and a program that I'm here to talk about today, which is HOPE Crew.
Tell me about HOPE Crew.
So HOPE Crew is an acronym, and it stands for the Hands-On Preservation Experience. And it's we started this program in 2014 to engage a younger, more diverse audience in historic preservation through the trades training. We primarily do this in national parks to help them address deferred maintenance. But then we also bring volunteers to the program as well to get them involved. And so since 2014, we've paid and trained about 750 young people and veterans and involved about 3,500 volunteers in preserving our national parks and addressing deferred maintenance in those parks as well.
Why deferred maintenance, though? Doesn't the federal government help?
The federal government does help, and they do provide some funding, but decades of chronic underfunding by Congress, coupled with the rising popularity of our national parks, it left them extremely in a precarious position. So their increased visitation is happening. Just last year alone, we had about 330 million visitors to our national parks, and over the past 5 years, there have been 1.5 billion visits to those same parks. And what's happening is there's aging park facilities. They're incurring more wear and tear than normal. And, you know, to be honest, Peter, the Congress hasn't allocated the appropriate level of funding to our national parks in my lifetime. So over 50 years have passed since Congress has dedicated a right amount of funding to preserve these historic resources.
And in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, because I could be wrong, isn't there proposals to make that money totally disappear out of the federal budget?
Well, not completely disappear. What we're dealing with is we're advocating for a legislation that's making its way, but out of the House, actually. So we're advocating for a legislation to go through called Restore Our Parks, and that will give these national parks $6.5 billion over 5 years towards the $11.5 billion that's currently there in deferred maintenance backlog.
And when you say deferred maintenance, what are you talking about? What's not getting done?
Sure. So these are places like Little Bighorn National Monument, where we've done a Hope Crew project before, but they have thousands of headstones that are there that have not been preserved. Or if we think of places like the Statue of Liberty, that not only interprets American freedom, but it tells an immigration story there as well at Ellis Island in the New York Harbor. And that particular park has about $160 million in deferred maintenance. So that's things like basic carpentry repairs, there's masonry, there's crumbling infrastructure that's happening. The Little Rock Central High School, where the story of desegregation is told, and also the Brown v. Board of Education is also connected to that park as well. That particular park has deferred maintenance issues. So there's windows that need restoration. There's masonry that needs cleaning and repointing. There's ADA upgrades that need to be made. So these types of things are present across our park system, and we really need to advocate to get Congress to appropriate the correct amount of dollars to make this happen.
Well, let me ask a question. I mean, we're here in Philadelphia, and Independence Hall National Park, does it have deferred maintenance problems?
Most parks have deferred maintenance problems, and Independence National Historical Park is not alone. So they are on the list and one of the places that we're advocating to receive this funding. This is a national problem and one at the National Trust that we're advocating, along with our partner Pew Charitable Trust, to get these parks repaired and so we can maintain them for the next generation.
And not only is doing this important historically and ecologically, but it helps the economy, doesn't it?
It does, Peter. I mean, preservation, we say often, it means a job. So these parks, just the park being in a local community generates funding for that particular neighborhood. So if you think about a place like Yellowstone and the communities that surround that park, they benefit by having that national park in their backyard. There was a report done commissioned by a Pew Charitable Trust, that if the deferred maintenance backlog is fully addressed, it has the potential to generate an additional 110,000 infrastructure jobs. So these are 110,000 people going to work in an infrastructure that wasn't, or in jobs that were not there in the first place. And so these parks are job creators. There's $18 billion that can be generated in direct spending by national park visitors alone in those local areas that I mentioned around Yellowstone. So this is also an economic argument. This bill is definitely good for the country, Peter.
Well, certainly the economics, you know, all that secondary money of People got to eat. People buy souvenirs. People might sleep over.
Right.
And what's Congress's problem?
Well, right now the bill has bipartisan support. So in this particular political economy, it's not often that both sides of the aisle come together and agree on something. And preservation, and particularly this Restore Our Parks piece of legislation, has brought people from on both sides of the aisle together, and we can all agree that our story, our American story, is important, and our national parks tell those stories. So right now it's moving through the process, and of course it's not moving as quickly, and I think one of the reasons why, you know, I'm talking to you today is to get your listeners to call their Congress people to advocate for this piece of legislation, to visit the website for Hope Crew, which is www.savingplaces.org/Hope Crew, to get more information about the program and figure out a way to get involved here.
What's the guy in the White House likely to do if the legislation passes, or when it passes?
Well, the current administration is supportive of infrastructure, and not only in our national parks but around the country. And so this potential to generate more jobs and to address the infrastructure issue that we have, the aging infrastructure issue that we have, is something that has support in the administration. And so we're really pushing for this to happen, because I think it only benefits the country when people go to work to work on beautiful places like Yosemite National Park.
Mm. And what do you want us to do again?
Well, I want your listeners to call their Congress people and advocate for them to vote for this Restore Our Parks legislation. Again, you know, it has bipartisan support. It's repairing and rehabilitating places in America that tell our story. I want your visitors to visit our website, which again is www.savingplaces.org/Hope Crew, and learn a little bit more about the program that's designed to address deferred maintenance and involve a younger generation in preservation trades. Because again, Peter, as you know, our workforce, particularly around the trades, it's a graying workforce, and so we need to bring in young people to continue the rich tradition that we have, the rich cultural tradition that we have of preserving places that matter, and getting more masons and more carpenters and more people who are knowledgeable about maintaining historic resources involved in this field. And so please visit the website, and please advocate for your congressperson to vote for this piece of legislation when it goes up.
Are we better off calling the district office or trying to reach the congressperson in Washington?
I say both and. So write letters, and please call the local offices and be involved. I think, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And so here, I think, again, you know, but with bipartisan support and the type of the stories that are being told at these national parks, I think everybody should be behind Restore Our Parks and really pushing for this to go through.
With everybody obsessing about the election, though, should we do it now or give it a little while?
I would say keep pushing. I would say for people who are up for reelection, which are most folks, push on them. So if they do get those positions, they can continue the momentum that they've already built around the bill. And right after the election, if there are new people coming into those positions, this is a perfect time to bring them up to speed with how important American parks are to their district and to the people that comprise their district. So I would say it's an all hands on deck strategy, and you know, keep at it.
And as you said, your program is only one of many programs by the National Trust. If folks want information on the trust in general, what do they do?
Yeah, so again, the National Trust, we protect and advocate for places that tell the American story all around the country. And one of our other programs that we do, and this is a flagship program of the National Trust, is our National Treasures Campaign, or National Treasures Program. And this is where we take direct action to preserve and advocate for places that are significant to American history. And one of those places, of many of a portfolio, we tell a story of Joe Frazier's gym in Philadelphia, for example, right there on Broad Street. I know you're familiar with it. You know, we've worked around and worked with the property owner there to preserve and protect that particular historic resource in Philadelphia alone. So that's one of the ways that we've worked in your city to preserve and protect a place that means something not only to Philadelphia history, but to sports history, and that's Joe Fraser's Gym. So that's one of the, and we work, that program is a national program, so everything from Miami Marine Stadium to the Houston Astrodome to Madam C.J. Walker's mansion in upstate or in New York. They've all been a part of the National Treasures Campaign. And one other one that I mentioned that is right outside of Philly in New Jersey is Hinchliffe Stadium, which is a Negro League baseball stadium. And in 2014, we brought 700 volunteers with us to repaint that stadium in just one day. And so not only are we protecting with working with the city to protect and preserve that, that Negro League baseball stadium for another generation, but we've involved the community in being a part of this and repainting and repairing that stadium. And that's the beauty of preservation. It's participatory and it involves, it only thrives when there's local involvement, and Hinchliffe and the National Treasures Campaign is all about local communities and preserving those places.
And in fact, can you correct me if I'm wrong, please, Monica? People are starting to think about holiday gifts, whether it's Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, or Christmas. And a membership in the National Trust is an incredible bargain. Get a fabulous magazine, and don't you get free admission to trust sites?
Yeah, so that's a part of our membership. And in our membership, we are always looking for ways to get more people involved and become a part of the National Trust family. So I would certainly recommend for your visitors to or your listeners to sign up for a membership at the National Trust and be more involved and active. You know, Peter, one thing that I should have mentioned earlier is that this past summer we did a Hope Crew project at Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia. So working locally with a local organization called Power Corps PHL, and we involved young local participants in preserving those spaces. Or Eastern State Penitentiary, rather, and a membership to the National Trust will help grow programs like Hope Crew to continue doing the great work that we do in communities throughout the country.
And certainly you can look on the web. Is there an 800 number for the Trust?
Yeah, there certainly is. But we really advocate for people to visit our website, and they can really learn more about that. But if you want to call in and definitely talk to someone, we're certainly available for that. I would recommend you call our direct office line, which is 202-588-6000. And you can be directed straight to our membership office and talk to one of my amazing colleagues about the benefits of the National Trust membership and the great things we're up to within the organization.
And indeed, they are great things. I've visited several National Trust sites. It's on my bucket list to get to the ball before I leave the planet. So I want to say thank you. And I want to say thank you to Monica Rhodes from the National Trust for the Historic Preservation for the fine work the Trust does. Thank you, Monica.
Peter, thank you. And thank you for your support for the National Trust.
My pleasure. And you're listening to WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. Remember to vote, vote, vote on Tuesday. The WIP time, 7:18. And we're back. My name's Peter Solomon. It's WIP Sunday. And there's an old Scottish prayer. Lord, protect us from ghosties and ghoulies and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night. And my next guest has some things to say about that and a whole lot more. Dr. Bruce Solheim, PhD. And he's got some things to say about paranormal experiences. Good morning, Dr. Solheim.
Yes, good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. What do you think about that prayer? Should we be worried?
Yes and no. I think the things to worry about are pretty. It's pretty evident what they are. You know, like demonic things and you know those types of things. And the interesting thing about it, I believe that they can only harm you if you invite them in. So you have to be careful. I think. You know, spirits and things like that, at least in my experience, are not harmful, and there's nothing really to be afraid of there. But But there are harmful things out there in the spirit world that, as long as you don't invite them in, they would like you to think they have more power than they do. But if you do invite them in, and you it could be trouble for you. Could spell trouble.
Now, there's been an increased, it seems to me anyway, interest in things paranormal and spirit world stuff, whether it was the revival of The Exorcist into a TV series, whether there's another new series now about Sabrina the Teenage Witch and her paranormal mm-hmm. adventures, two examples right there. What do you think that means? Are we more interested, or are we starting to get a little scared, or both?
I think the world is a pretty frightening place, and people start seeking solace in different avenues, and through religion or through a spiritual life, a lot of people find comfort in that. And for the last 25 years or so, church attendance has been down, and people are seeking other methods. I myself, grew up in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and so I have a very deep, spiritual background, and I believe in God. But I think that this type of thing is really people are searching for something deeper than just the what we see in this life, and they also want to be connected to those that have passed on, their family members, and seek comfort in that. So I think it's a natural kind of thing, I believe that there is, you are right, I think there's some kind of paradigm shift going on, and I'm not the only one that says that. There's a lot of people who would agree with you. The scientists like Dean Radin at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, who's one of the leading psychic researchers in the world, he has noted this as well, and upswell in the number of people or percentage of people that are interested. About 90% of the population is interested in the paranormal, and about I think upwards of 60% believe to have had at least one paranormal experience in their life. So that's a pretty high percentage of people. I'm talking about millions and millions of people.
Well, so you're suggesting it's people questioning that old Piggy song. Is that all there is?
I believe so. It's comforting to know that, if I go back to my Sunday school days, they were talking about, life everlasting and heaven and so forth. And I've had experiences with like my mother, for instance, who came to me after she died, and she was all golden and in one of the visions that I have and I've had since really I was 4 years old. And my mother came to me and said, there is a heaven. That's all she said. She's usually, when I see her and hear her, it's very short, things that she says, but very powerful, extremely powerful. And it's very comforting. And I wasn't able to ask her more questions or anything, but I have had more experiences with her. And then I've had experiences with others who have passed on, friends of mine who I actually talk to quite frequently. So,
all right. Tell me about those experiences as you chronicle them in your new book.
Yeah, well, the first experience I had was at age 4, and it was in northern Norway. We were living with my father's mother, my grandmother, on a remote island 200 miles above the Arctic Circle. And it was wintertime, and I was outside playing, and I started to become really sick. I had a high fever, body aches, and terrible headache. I couldn't move my head. My neck was stiff, so I went home, and my grandmother was in the kitchen. She had me lie down on this little bed she had in the corner in the kitchen, and all the relatives started to come over and saying, scary, terrible, scary things like, oh, this is what happened to Uncle Sven when he got polio, or somebody else got sick and they died the next day. So I was crying, and I was upset. I remember being very upset, thinking I was going to die, I kind of drifted off into a very uneasy sleep, and then I woke up. I was alone in the kitchen, and there was this bright light up in the ceiling in this old farm home, and it was a bright light. It was very warm, and I felt like everything was going to be okay. I felt like I had no worries, and I was able to go back to sleep and sleep well. And when I woke up, I was perfectly fine. I wasn't sick at all. And my mother and my grandmother told me that it was a miracle. And I told them about the bright light and, what had happened, and they said it was my guardian angel. So from that point on, I just accepted it as part of this is life. This it's not just what what's out there that we see every day, but there's these other, you know, miraculous things. And it kind of, I think that incident kind of opened up the floodgates for me for a lifetime of encounters with the paranormal.
And you chronicle those in your new book. The title, please, Doctor?
Yeah, it's the new book is called Timeless, A Paranormal Personal History. So I'm a historian, so I organize it chronologically. So it's, you know, it starts at age 4 and goes to, you know, just, you know, a few months ago, just before the book was published, you know, things were still happening, and they still happen today. It covers everything from, you know, like I say, angelic experiences on the positive side to very negative things like demonic type things. Also full apparition ghosts and telekinesis and telepathy. You know, it covers the full range of the paranormal. I'm kind of like a lightning rod for the paranormal.
Well, that's interesting to say the least. Ever had an evil experience?
Yeah, there was one that was I'll tell you the telekinetic one. I have a couple of demonic ones too, but the telekinetic one, and telekinesis being where somebody uses their mind to manipulate matter, in other words, move things with their mind. I was living in Germany with my first wife, and we were living in this above this German. It's called a Gasthaus, like a restaurant bar, and there's rooms to rent up above it. It's near the base where we were in Mannheim, West Germany. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and I felt like somebody was literally pulling me off the bed by my legs, by my feet, you know, grabbing me. So I looked over. My wife was sound asleep next to me, so it wasn't her, and there wasn't anybody else in the room. I just had that feeling. So I got up, very unnerving. And then I looked at the nightstand, and the nightstand, there was stuff vibrating on the nightstand, like the alarm clock, my wife's hairbrush and her hand mirror and a couple other things. And then I just happened to look out the window that faced kind of a green belt behind this apartment that we lived in. And on the other side of that green belt was another big apartment building. And I noticed somebody standing in the window and kind of in the shadows, but I could see it was a person, and they were pointing at me. And as soon as they noticed me staring at them, they put their hand down, they moved off into the darkness, and the vibration stopped. And so I'm not sure who that person was, but they were able to manipulate things in our apartment, you know, the windows facing each other. And it was extremely frightening knowing that somebody had the ability to. I'm assuming that you know, that it wasn't a good intent. You know, it was some kind of evil intent. And my wife, on top of that, who also was very psychic, she said that she had the feeling that somebody had been killed or had committed suicide in that apartment. So we only lived there for about another month, and we moved out pretty quick. So that's one of the worst ones that I've had.
All right, because I think it's the evil that concerns people. Do you believe in evil?
Yeah. I think that there are demonic forces that would be construed as evil and malevolent. And I've had a couple of encounters with kind of demonic stuff. And I think the best way, before I tell this, I could tell a couple of stories about it. But the first thing I wanted to say is that you have reason to be concerned, but you also, it should be somewhere between hysteria and complacency. You should just be aware of it and realize that you can inoculate yourself. And the first way to inoculate yourself to not be affected by it is to not buy into it. You know, don't if something just sounds wrong, like just it just doesn't sound right, and it's just too easy, and you just get a bad feeling in your gut. Trust those instincts. You know, that would be one. But the other is that. These evil entities, they like you to think that you have less power than you do. And part of it's because of, you know, you mentioned The Exorcist, you know, part of it's Hollywood's depiction of things. It kind of sensationalizes, whether it's, you know, the evil or just, you know, magic in general, you know, this idea that, you know, that all this stuff can happen, this Harry Potter kind of stuff. So actually the paranormal world is actually a lot more subtle, but in most cases. But anyway, back. So I think people should, you know, if they're religious people, they can say prayers. If they're not religious but have some kind of spirituality, just realize, you know, hey, I have control over my domain where I am, and to just push it away. And that's, as long as you don't invite it in, you should be fine. But I'll give you an example.
Before we do that, doctor, I got to take a quick break for some commercials.
Yeah, sure.
When we come back, we're going to get some stories. All this and more coming up here on WIP Sunday, the WIP time, 7:35. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Dr. Bruce Soheim, expert on things paranormal. Doctor?
Yes. Okay. no, go ahead, Peter. I'm sorry.
Okay. No. Tell us some stories, please.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll tell you on the scarier side, another scary story. When I was 18 years old, very low point in my life, no job, you know, about to lose my girlfriend because I was just being a jerk, and you know, just a very low point. Well, I was cutting across some yards, which I did. I grew up in Seattle, and where I lived in kind of the suburbs north of Seattle. I did the same thing at 18 that I did when I was a kid. I didn't walk on the roads when I walked around. I didn't have a car either, so that was another low point. But anyway, so I would just cross through yards, jump over fences, you know, just the straight route. I had done that since I was a little kid, me and my friends. Well, one night I was doing that, and I was going through the yard of this old lady who lived by herself, and we always thought she was the neighborhood witch, and there was a lot of, you know, rumors about her, and she had blackberry bushes that grew up to the, that were all the way up to the roof line of her house, and so that horrified the parents because of bringing down property values or whatever, but for us, we just thought she was a witch. Well, I was cutting across her yard, and I saw a light in the window, and I just kind of glanced over there, and then I saw her, and she was in the window, and she had this gray hair that went off in every direction. She was holding a candlestick, and she was she had this like cancerous thing on her nose that, you know, was growing or whatever, and that actually killed her. But anyway, I was just like caught like a deer in the headlights. Just, oh my gosh, I just froze, and she was staring at me, and she didn't look very happy. And you know, that I was in her yard, and so I just eventually broke away, and I went back to where I was staying. I was living in my brother's garage, sleeping on a bare mattress, and it's pretty sad. But anyway, I kind of drifted off to sleep, and then in the middle of the night, I woke up, and there was this column of fire that was coming from the foot of my mattress, where my feet were, up over my head, and on the other, so, you know, over me in like a 6-foot arc, and it was like a river or a column of fire. It's the best way I can describe it, like it was moving. And with that, accompanying that was a deep, growly voice that was speaking in some language I didn't understand, but it was very, very frightening, obviously a very evil kind of thing. And it probably only lasted for a couple of minutes, but it seemed like I was kind of locked into this for much longer. And then it stopped, and I had to make sure I was, you know, wasn't a dreaming, so I was like, you know, pinching myself, slapping myself. No, this did happen. So I called my girlfriend, and she wasn't very happy for me to call her in the middle of the night, but she said, well, why don't you come over in the morning? So I did. The next morning, I barely slept. I didn't really sleep until I could come over there. And then she, you know, listened to my story, and she goes, well, maybe we should call a psychiatrist. What do you think? And at that point, I just said, forget it. Okay, it was probably a bad dream. Let's, you know, move on. But it did happen. It did happen. And I think it had something to do with that old lady. And I must have really made her mad or whatever. But that's, you know, the bottom line is that that's when these kind of evil entities can strike. You know, that's when this kind of stuff can happen, is when you're at a low point, you feel terrible about yourself, you have no self-confidence, you don't have a self-defense. It's like having low immunities, and that's usually when you get diseases and stuff, when your immune system is low. So that, I think it's the same thing with the spirit world, these negative things. You know, that's when they can strike, and if you're not careful, it could, you know, do a lot of harm to you. Yeah, that was probably one of... Yeah, go ahead.
When I was a kid, one of the movies I saw that scared the bejesus out of me was The Haunting of Hill House, the original version. Ever see it?
I've heard of it. I can't say that I probably have seen it, but I can't remember it exactly.
It's about this house that was supposedly born in evil. And I remember at some point interviewing the famous ghost hunter couple, the Warrens. Lorraine and I forget her husband's name, Warren, and they said that's the way a haunted house is. Do you believe in haunted houses?
Oh yeah, I've encountered that. I had a full ghost apparitional experience in the old Academy building in New London, New Hampshire. I was there for a job interview, and it was full on. I mean, like a ghost. I saw the ghost of Mrs. Colby, who was the original founder of the college, and I had I heard an old Victrola playing, the sound of people, you know, moving around and talking and chairs moving around. Of course, there was nobody there. I checked it out while this was going on. And so, yeah, I that was definitely a haunted building. And so, yes, I do. I not only believe it, I know it to be true because experience is better than belief, you know.
Well, but when you saw these things,
yeah,
were they tangible, like you could reach out and touch them, or were they more ethereal?
It was more ethereal. She was, Mrs. Colby was, semi-translucent. She was there, though, definitely there. I didn't try to touch her. I was just kind of lying there in bed and looking at her and hoping that she would go away. But I have been touched by, I didn't see them when they did it, but I have been touched by spirits, physically touched. The most recent one was in Old Town San Diego at the Cosmopolitan Hotel, which is a well-known haunted location. My family and I were down in San Diego, and we decided to go on a ghost tour, which is always something I'm interested in. And in the Cosmopolitan Hotel, I was touched on the arm, which felt like by a kind of a feminine touch. You know, it wasn't like a guy when he grabs you, or, you know, not trying to be sexist or anything, but it just felt like a feminine touch on my arm, and there was nobody there. There was nobody around me. And I've had in my grandmother's house in northern Norway after she had passed away when we were there, I felt her grab my shoulder from behind, and there was nobody there. And I knew that it was her. I could even, it smelled like her, what she smelled like. I've been touched by spirits, but I haven't like necessarily touched them, but they've touched me.
Ever wondered why me?
I have. When I was younger, I just thought maybe everybody had this kind of stuff. But when I started talking to people, they either got scared or they didn't want to talk about it or change the subject or thought I was lying. You know, as kids do, they're pretty harsh with each other sometimes. So I just kind of tucked it in the back of my mind. I thought, well, maybe this is a pretty normal thing. That's why I think, you know, the paranormal is really more normal than people think it is. But I think it's both a blessing and kind of a curse. You know, it's more of a blessing than a curse, you know, because I think there's a special reason why I have this connection. I know now why, and that's what prompted me to write this book and finally record all these stories in spite of my fears that I would be maybe, you know, retired early from my job, and maybe my peers would not take my historical work seriously. And, you know, but all those fears were unfounded. Actually, since I've come out with the book and been on, a couple of radio shows here and there, people come up to me and they see me as a safe source to reveal their stories. So I there's a real purpose for doing this, and I see it as more of a blessing than a curse, although it can be very scary sometimes.
Ever wonder if you were crazy?
Not well. My girlfriend thought I was. That's why she wanted to call a psychiatrist. But I'll tell you this: if I am crazy, I'm a very high functioning crazy. I'll put it that way, because I've accomplished a lot in my life. Not to brag, but I mean, I don't think so. No.
All right. It's been suggested to me that this stuff runs in families. Does it run in yours?
Yes, my mother was very psychic. We could do telepathy. We would unnerve my father, who was not a believer or an experiencer, at least, he didn't admit it. we would get playing cards, and when we were camping when I was younger, my mom and I used to try to read each other's minds using these cards. And we'd get a pretty good hit rate, you know, way beyond chance, and sometimes right on. And it my dad would let us do it for a while, and he'd laugh, and then all of a sudden he'd just say, okay, that's it, knock it off, put that away. So my mom would just wink at me, and we put the cards away listening to dad. But so I know it came from her. And her mother was a on this remote island. Well, there's no hospitals anywhere nearby. She was a healer and a herbalist. So yeah, it does run in the family. And I've heard that from other people too, who have these, you know, these gifts that we've been given.
Have any children, Doctor?
Yes, I have four, ranging in age from 38 to 18. And I'm not sure. I think that they're all quite intuitive. None of them have, you know, I mean, they know what about this book and stuff. And I suspect my daughter is probably pretty high functioning, but as a, as you know, psychically. But we haven't sat down, and I haven't imparted what I've, you know, the knowledge that I've gained yet. But I will at a certain point when she becomes. I always. I think it's good to wait until people become curious enough to start asking you a lot of questions. And at that point, you know, rather than trying to dump it on them, you know, and say, okay, this is what how it works. You wait till they come to you. That's when the, you know, what's the old saying? The teacher will appear when the student is ready to learn.
Absolutely. One more time, the name of the book?
Timeless, A Paranormal Personal History. And you can find it on Amazon. The cheapest place that I've found it is Amazon for $9.95. That's a pretty good price. And I have a website, too, if they want to check out other things that I'm doing. BruceOlavSolheim.com. Middle name spelled O-L-A-V. Last name S-O-L-H-E-I-M. And that's how they can get a hold of me and check out the book.
Why did you write the book?
What's that?
Why did you write the book?
Well, I've always wanted to, but I was afraid of you know, losing my job. You know, in academe, they're pretty you know, that although a lot of people have had experiences, they don't want to admit it. They don't want to lose their jobs or not be taken as credible. So, 2 years ago, a good friend of mine died. Also, grew up in the Norwegian American community in Seattle, and he died, and he came to me in a vision about a month after he died, and he encouraged me. He gave me a lot of information about how the spirit world works, because we were very close as friends, and he encouraged me. He said, now's the time to publish this book and let people know what you know, what you've been experiencing, and this will be helpful for people. And he even gave me the idea for the title, because he told me that I asked a question that probably most people would ask if you encounter someone that's passed on and you're actually communicating with them. I said, what's it like to be dead? You know, what's it like where you are? And he laughed and he said, well, I don't really feel dead. He said, I'll just tell you this. I just am. There's no past. There's no future. It's just an eternal now. And he said, and it's beautiful. And so it was very encouraging, and so this idea of timelessness came to me from what he told me, and that's thereby the title of the book. And the hopefulness that I try to convey in the book is that we do live forever. Our physical bodies, of course, don't, but our spirit in the spirit world, some people would say soul, you know, this idea does live forever. And I want people to not be so terribly afraid of dying that they are afraid to live. So that's the kind of baseline message for the whole thing.
An important message given the condition of our world today.
Yes, I believe so.
Let me say thank you to Dr. Bruce Solheim for an instructive interview. Thank you, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And you've been listening to another edition of WIP Sunday here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sonny Hale. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. Your opinion, Sonny's reactions, I know I'll be listening. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and to Ann Tideman-Solomon, my dear wife and associate producer. Couldn't do it without either one of you. Remember, Tuesday is Election Day, and if you do nothing else, vote. Vote, vote, vote. It's of critical importance. One vote, history tells us, can make a difference. Vote and be a part of history. Nothing left to say, but see you soon.